The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This is the best of the Eric Metaxas Show.
It's the show everyone's talking about,
but they really should be listening to it.
Broadcasting from the Empire State Building because the Chrysler Building wasn't available.
This is the Eric Metaxas Show.
Your host, Eric Metaxas.
Hey, I'm Eric Metaxas. Maybe you already knew that, but what you might not have known is that this week I am actually not at all in the Empire State Building, not even in New York. I'm across the pond. No, not in New Jersey. In England. Yes, I'm in Oxford, England right now doing a special series of Socrates in the City events. That's Socrates in the City. And I wanted to share them with you, my radio audience. So now let's listen in to the Socrates in the City event I did yesterday, or it may have been the day before. I'm getting confused with the jet lag, but very recently. I hope you enjoy it. Pip, pip, cheerio, and so on and so forth. Thank you.
Welcome to Socrates in the City, Oxford edition. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. I cannot tell you how excited I am about this, because for me this is a dream come true. For years, I have wanted to interview Walter Hooper. And it's taken me this long. I apologize, Walter, but we're finally here in Oxford to do this. Walter Hooper, in case you don't know who he is, was, in 1963, the secretary to C.S. Lewis. Spent time living with Lewis, working with him, and soon thereafter, when Lewis died on the same day that, the same hour that President Kennedy died, Walter Hooper took on the huge, immeasurable task of doing all that needed to be done to sort of secure his literary legacy, to republish works that had fallen out of print, and really to edit his work for decades it's been now. It's just gigantic. It's a lifelong devotion. It seems to me a calling. And for me, it's a tremendous privilege to get this time with Walter Hooper. So please, Socrates in the City, welcome for Walter Hooper. You know, if I'm pushed, I would describe myself as a mere Christian. Yeah. You know, that's my denomination. And I think Lewis helped people in some ways avoid, the straitjacket of a particular denomination. And just to say that I'm with Lewis, yes, I'm with historical Christianity, I'm with traditional Christianity, I think that that's something he may have intended to some extent. Do you think that was intentional, because he is so appreciated across the spectrum?
Mere Christianity is part an answer to what are the core beliefs. This is the main part of what Christianity is. And so far, it seems to serve that purpose. Mm. And even the Catholic writers like that too. And I discovered, fairly recently in modern time, that Pope John Paul II liked Lewis very early on. In 1950, says his biographer, he was already reading with his students the Screwtape Letters. And then in 1978, when he became Pope, he mentioned in one of his sermons that the four loves, which he loved, was on a level with the writings of St. Augustine. And in 1984, jumping ahead, I was invited by a priest came to Oxford to see if I would come and visit the Pope. Well, I thought, this is just, I can't believe that he wants me to come and see him. So I said, well, I'll think about it. And I thought, I just don't believe this.
Anyway, I don't believe that, that you said that.
Well, he got back and he said, I realize how very busy you are, but couldn't you spare 5 minutes with the Pope? I said, of course I could, you know. So anyway,
I went there.
I went there 1984 November and had an audience with the Pope. I was simply terrified. But he said, he began by saying, do you still love your old friend C.S. Lewis? I thought that's a very pastoral thing to say. You still love him? I said, oh yes, Holy Father, both friendship and affection. He said, oh, you knew I liked the Four Loves. I said, almost everybody in the world does, you know. So he talked about that, but then he had read Mere Christianity and many of the other works as well. And then he wanted to know from me, this is why I was there, what was he like? Well, I did my best to say what he was like. And at the end, I hoped he would say something about Lewis. And I think he knew I was waiting for him to say something. So at the end, he said, C.S. Lewis knew what his apostolate was. I didn't want to know whether he'd finished. And then he said, and he did it. And I thought, that's the nicest thing ever said about Lewis. He knew what his apostolate was, and he did it. You know, because you can know what your apostolate is and not do it. But here's a man who did it. And he knew what he should do, and he did it.
And he's also effectively calling Lewis an apostle.
Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm. So what I've been going back to saying is that I realized from the Decree on Ecumenism that Catholics were now free to read Lewis, and they began when many of the Anglicans were becoming, and many other denominations were caught up in, you know, in liberalism. There were some new readers of C.S. Lewis, and I was keen to catch those new readers, so I went to every conference that was I was invited to give talks on Lewis. You know, and when I went and joined Alice von Hildebrand in 1989 at Steubenville, I found that most of the Catholics were there because they wanted to hear me talk about the abolition of man.
Yeah.
And when Cardinal Ratzinger came to Oxford, Cambridge in 1988, I didn't see him at that time, but he gave his talk on the abolition of man.
Ratzinger.
Because Ratzinger...
Whatever happened to Ratzinger?
When he became Pope Benedict XVI.
Oh, come
but
on.
But as before he became Pope, as you know, he said the biggest danger we now face is the dictatorship of relativism.
Yeah.
And so that explains why he would care so much about Lewis's abolition of man.
The abolition of man is absolutely prophetic.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
no question about it. Gosh, there's so much to talk about here. I think that, you know, when we say prophetic, people think we're talking about getting direct revelation. It needn't be direct revelation. It can be direct revelation. But I would say that someone's understanding can be affected by revelation, and it's kind of transmuted into something like the abolition of man. But Lewis's ability to see these things, there's no way to describe it except prophetic, because he's saying things that are so deeply true. Anyone might have seen these things, but it doesn't seem that anyone else did, and that's what makes a prophet a prophet. Not that they're saying something that doesn't exist. They're speaking it, and other people recognize it as true, but no one else is speaking it as true. For him to write the abolition of man so early, you said 42.
Yes.
It's an extraordinary thing.
Well, and I think you probably realize, you know, the first series of talks on the Christianity talks are about natural law as well.
Yeah.
They are on the moral law, as he calls it.
This is a special Oxford edition of the Eric Metaxas Show. There is more of this conversation with Professor Walter Hooper coming up next. Welcome back to a special version of the Eric Metaxas Show. It's a Socrates in the City event in Oxford, England. Right now, we're talking to Professor Walter Hooper about all things C.S. Lewis. Let's rejoin the conversation.
But you call it natural law. He wouldn't have called it natural law.
No, he wouldn't, because he didn't want it to be thought to be a Roman Catholic term.
Yeah.
I mean, after all, he used different terms to make it fresher.
Yeah.
You know? He never actually mentions the resurrection. The resurrection, but he talks about when Christ rose from the dead. You know? I mean, so he avoids well-known words which, you know, sound like traditional Christianity. He tried to give it a fresh approach. You can't. It's still true, even if though you use slightly different words for it.
Well, okay, it can be more true if you use slightly different words. Well, that's the thing. Basically, he was saying that it's a famous quote. So if somebody Googles stained glass and Lewis and Narnia, they'll come up with it. But maybe trappings. But that he said that you cannot really see it if you've seen it so often. You become inured to what you're looking at, and you no longer see it. You take it for granted. And we have to recast it. And that's what he was doing in the Narnia books.
Yes.
When you recast it, suddenly people can see it. I've actually found that if I'm reading a verse of scripture in a foreign language, and if I know what it says in that foreign language, it's refreshed.
Yes.
And I can actually hear it in a way that I can no longer hear it in English, because the English has become stale. I've heard it so often. And there are terms like resurrection. I would say this is when vibrant green faith becomes dead religion. It becomes ossified, and you can have the trappings and the, but lack the power thereof. That to me is Lewis's principal strength, is that he was able in so many different ways and so many different genres to refresh our understanding of immutable, eternal truths. That's tremendous accomplishment. I cannot think of anyone in the 20th century who did it in anything that can compare with how he did it.
Yes, it's one of his essays on the fairy tales say better what's to be said.
Yeah.
And the quotation is in the... we wanted to get past those Sunday school associations and the stained glass association, which sounds almost, and we talk, as though we were talking about a medical matter, some way to get past those watchful dragons that keep us from attending to the truth. And getting past those watchful dragons is what he did so well. You know, he was willing to talk about the Narnian stories with me. He didn't really like talking about his own book, but we talked about. I told him the one time that my favorite character was Paxford, I mean, the Puddleglum and the silver chair. And he says, well, you know Puddleglum pretty well. You met him a number of times. He's Paxford the gardener. I based it on him. Paxford was the most pessimistic man who ever lived, but he wanted the nicest. But he, Lewis gave me a very good example of his pessimism, his puddle glumishness. He said when he and Joy were going to Greece in 1960, Joy's cancer had returned. And they were going with their friends, Roger and June Lancelin Green. But he said, here am I, an old man walking with a stick, Joy with cancer return. What were we doing, going, you know, to Greece of all places. Anyway, he said the last straw seemed to have been arrived when Paxford came out to say goodbye to us. He was always listening to the wireless, the radio. And he said, well, Mr. Jack, there was this airplane that's just gone down. Everybody killed and burnt beyond recognition. Did you hear that, Mr. Jack? Burnt beyond recognition. And on that note, said Lewis, we flew to Greece.
Wow. I think we all have a little... We all have Paxfords and Puddleglums in our lives, and I have to say, I find it hard to like people like that. But and Puddle, it's funny that you say Puddleglum is one of your favorite characters. He's one of my least favorite precisely because that kind of thing drives me out of my mind. But this brings me to something... else, but Puddleglum, the name Puddleglum puts me in mind of it. Lewis's imaginative power is evidenced in part by his ability to create names and words. Puddleglum is genius. The term Puddleglum. Puddleglum, for those of you who remember, it's in the Silver Chair, that he only appears in the Silver Chair. But he's described as a particular creature called a marsh wiggle. When you read that, a marsh wiggle is sort of brown, a little bit like a salamander or creature or something like that. But he invents a creature. To be able to plausibly invent a new creature is absolute staggering genius to do this effectively, because anybody can come up with some stupid creature that it isn't plausible, it's just a hot... But he creates a plausible creature that never existed, gives it this name of a marsh wiggle, which is just brilliant, and then names the marsh wiggle Puddleglum. Mm-hmm. It's so appropriate. Lewis did that innumerable times in the Narnia Chronicles. He did it... With I think maybe my favorite is when he's talking about, and I always get them mixed up, it's not in the Silver Chair, where he's talking about the land of Bism, which one? Is that the Silver Chair? He's talking about this world underneath this world. Definitely. And this is, again, just outrageous power, imaginative power to create that world and to say that it's inhabited by these kinds of creatures. But he gives them names that I find delightful and hilarious and apt. G-O-L-G, Golg, is such a strange name. It's the land of Bism, B-I-S-M, Bism. And he over and over again does that kind of thing. And it's very hard to pull off. But he does it, and it shows me, it's part of how I see his greatness.
Definitely. Well, not only wonderful names like that, but distinctions. You know, for children to read, here's one of the most important distinctions, I think. I wonder how many adult books have anything as brilliant as this in it. In the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, they stop at this island where the people are invisible, and Lucy goes in and into the magician's house, and she wants to read the spell that would make them visible, and she does in the end. But she also is attracted to the magical book, because one of the spells, if you say it, will help you hear what your friends say about you. And she can't resist it, and she says it. And so what she sees is like a train journey. These two friends of hers are one her close friend, and then somebody she doesn't know very well. And the close friend is intimidated by the bigger girl, who said, are you still seeing that little Lucy Pevensey? Oh, well, I don't really like her very much. I mean, she just throws herself at me. I'm just, you know, I'm friends because she wants to be friends with me. And poor Lucy breaks into tears. And then Aslan appears, and he says, you know, eavesdropping, you know, but reading these spells is same as eavesdropping in real life. But will I ever forget it? No, says Aslan, that's the problem. You won't forget it. But he said, there's a big distinction you should make here. There's a big difference between what your friends say about you and what they think about you. And your friend thinks very well of you. She loves you very much, but she was afraid of that girl. To make a distinction between what your friends say about you and what they think about you, what modern novel has anything as profound as that in it?
This is a special Oxford edition of the Eric Metaxas Show. There is more of this conversation with Professor Walter Hooper coming up next.
That ain't no way to treat a lady, no way to treat your baby, your woman, your friend. That ain't no way to treat a lady, no way. But maybe it's a way for us to end. I was only being a picture.
Oh, that Moses.
Welcome back to the Eric Metaxas Show from Oxford, England, where I'm hosting several Socrates in the City events. Right now, we're talking to Professor Walter Hooper about all things C.S. Lewis. Let's rejoin the conversation.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, the reason that Lewis is so amazing and I hope will last forever is that I can hardly think of anyone who has such an array of gifts. Tremendous wisdom, humor, and as I say over and over, tremendous creative power, imaginative power. I can hardly think of anyone who's his equal. There are passages at the end of Perelandra that are unlike anything I have ever read. He doesn't seem to get a tenth of the credit that he should in the Academy. Have you seen that effect as you've put his work out there, that people in the Academy, people who decide what ought to be part of the Western canon, have you seen them turn away from Lewis? Because it seems to me that if the world weren't crazy, some of his works would be taught. I mean, for example, Perelandra ought to be taught alongside Paradise Lost in a survey course, for example. It rises to the level of genuinely great literature, much greater than many things that are now part of the canon.
Well, I think part of the you said, someone told me yesterday that we were talking to somebody who said Lewis was not very popular here. When I first came to England and first got to know Professor Tolkien, he knew I was puzzled as to why, say, Magdalen College, some of the dons had not liked Lewis. He said, you see, in Oxford, you are only allowed, forgiven for writing two different things. You can write works on your field of study, like history or art or theology or whatever it is, and you can write detective stories, because all dons at some point get the flu and they have to have something to read in bed. But you're not forgiven is writing popular works on some outside your field, especially popular works which become internationally famous. But he said Lewis knew that, but the reason he wrote them was because he was driven by his conscience.
He knew his apostolate.
Yep, yes. Mm-hmm.
Well,
and he knew it would cost him too.
Yeah, you know, but his faith was strong enough that he didn't care. Yeah. He was doing what he felt God called him to do and made him to do. But I still am amazed that some of his works, I think most notably probably Perelandra,
yes,
are not part of the canon of Western literature in the 20th century.
Yes,
it
yes,
seems
yes.
to be something that it doesn't fit in with the narrative. Yes, I mean, the idea that Jack Kerouac's On the Road or Allen Ginsberg's Howl or any number of works that are infinitely inferior to Perelandra would be thought of as appropriate to be in the canon is... has much less to do with literary quality than to do with the fact that they plug into the narrative somehow. That, you know, even works by Fitzgerald or Hemingway, they're okay. They're not. There's nothing spectacular about them. Even Faulkner. I hope I'm not stepping on your southern toes by saying it, but some of his stuff just seems pretentious. And yet, the 20th century, that was the time to be pretentious. That was the time to try to do things that screamed, look at me, I'm a modernist, or look at me, I'm a postmodernist. And if you didn't do that, you were likely to be ignored. I also know that has everything to do with Lewis's outspokenness about his Christian faith. But have you ever talked to anyone about that issue, that Lewis... That some of his works, which are so great, and the Narnia books are probably the ultimate example, but they sort of disqualify themselves because they're thought of as kids' literature. But the idea that he's not accepted in that way.
Well, I noticed that Lewis's newest books and those of Tolkien almost never reviewed in any of the papers, any of the journals, even though they will sell in the millions and the others won't. In 2000, I think it was, some of you may remember better than I do, but there was one of the largest polls ever taken of books in this country, the largest poll amongst readers, not about critics. And anyway, Tolkien's Lord of the Rings was number one, and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was number 14. So they were very high on the list. And I was appalled to see that they were condemned. All the newspapers condemned these the critics, condemned Lewis and Tolkien. Because they believed something else. They didn't really like Christianity. They felt a strong desire to strike at it in this way in the poll. But As I'm reminded what some of the Tolkien family, I said, don't worry about this. After all, it's the people, something like 400,000 people are the ones who said your father's work is the best that is, and Lewis's work, the best that is. So I wouldn't worry about that.
This is a special Oxford edition of the Eric Metaxas Show. There is more of this conversation with Professor Walter Hooper coming up next. This is the Eric Metaxas Show. Today you're hearing a special Socrates in the City version of the show drawn from a number of events that I hosted in Oxford, England. Here's more of my conversation with Professor Walter Hooper.
Part of what I guess it was you discovered was a manuscript of an unfinished novel called The Dark Tower, which led to some controversy. But what was that? Where was that manuscript, by
the
way?
This was one of those that was in the notebooks. It was a manuscript amongst the things that were being burnt when I took back to Keble College.
You dragged the Dark Tower down the hill in the suitcase.
I did, yes.
This is so amazing. Okay. So it wasn't just a few literary essays. Yeah, it was the Dark Tower. Okay. Well, the Dark Tower, for those who don't know what it is, as I said, an unfinished novel by Lewis. Yeah. It is... a little bit unlike anything else he ever did. When was it written? Maybe 1939?
I think probably about 1939. It was to be a sequel to Out of the Silent Planet.
Before he wrote Perelandra.
Before he wrote Perelandra. It was to, it sounds like the sequel to Out of the Silent Planet, which was published in 1938.
Yeah.
And so this would, you know, was written probably during the, at the beginning of the war, but before he began Perelandra. It was partial. He had written part of it, but didn't know how to go on with it. So he just put it aside and then started something else.
And never came back to it.
He never came
Which
back
happens.
To it.
Which happens. It happened to Dr. Seuss. I just read today that... Well, but it's the kind of thing, of course, I'm a writer, that you know, you can do that. But so he writes this, it's a fragment. I can remember how many pages, maybe 80 pages or something that. And I remember maybe it was in 98 or 2002, finally reading this and realizing that in some ways it's unlike Lewis, but in other ways it's clear that it is Lewis. The horror of it is you get glimpses of it in the rest of the Space Trilogy. I mean, these moments of real evil, real menace. And he can create an otherworldly horror that is so creepy that, again, it shows you his imaginative power. But the Dark Tower, I don't remember, when was that published, finally?
1977,
okay. Some people who will remain nameless eventually accused you of having either written the Dark Tower or having written parts of the Dark Tower and having then slipped it into the Lewis oeuvre just to get it out there. And when I read the Dark Tower, I didn't know you, and I didn't know too much about the controversy. I said, let me read this and let me see. But I read it, and whatever that instinct is made me say, oh, this is definitely Lewis. This is, it's too good to be anyone else. Now, I don't know your writing abilities, but I thought there's something about it that it's those flashes of the Lewis genius. And it is a very creepy story. But what was that like to have people take your genuine love of Lewis and selfless service of Lewis and his work and accuse you of having tried to profit from it in that ugly way, not just financially, which they also accused you of, but which is ridiculous, but to try to be sort of a literary parasite. I mean, it reminds me of it. It would make a great novel, except it seems to me not just untrue, but, you know, scandalously untrue. But what was that like, if you can just tell us, to live through having to deal with this?
It went on for 25 years, and there were three volumes involved by the same person. I was very sad at first, and the question was what to do. And my mother had said a number of things that came to my mind at that time. She said, if you can't say anything nice about somebody, then don't say anything at all. And I'm sure your mothers have said the same thing. But that came into my mind. I think God wanted me to have something simple to rely on. If you can't say anything nice about people, don't say anything at all. So I never replied. So the controversy, so-called, was completely one-sided because she said many, many things. I said nothing. I still think probably I did the right thing, but it was very, very painful. And I thought in the end, the pity is that a person chooses to spend her whole life just heaping abuse on somebody else, when it would be better to do anything than that, you know. But I think, you know, the person who does that is going to make themselves more and more and more unhappy. It was very painful to live through. And when that person died, well, Michael Warwood, whom you know, came to say, tell me, he said, I think you should know if you don't already, the person who's been persecuting you for 25 years says, die. Aren't you going to rejoice? Well, I don't know what I would have done, except that that was not what I wanted to do. So what helped me was to say a rosary for that person 7 days in a row, by which time I felt, you know, I didn't want to rejoice, you know. But anyway, then it was right after that. I don't know whether this person would have cared about this or not, but you and I both know that there appeared one of Lewis's pupils, Alistair Fowler, who had written a piece in the Yale Review. He didn't know about this controversy at all.
He didn't know anything about the controversy. He simply decided to write an essay in the Yale Review.
Yeah, yeah.
He was Lewis's pupil in 1952?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And he said that, you know, besides talking about the thesis that he was writing, Lewis was his supervisor. Lewis showed him The Dark Tower. And he said, I just don't know how to finish it. I don't know how to go on with it.
This is a special Oxford edition of the Eric Metaxas Show. There is more of this conversation with Professor Walter Hooper coming up next.
We shall rise. We shall rise.
This is the best of the Eric Metaxas Show.
Welcome back to the Eric Metaxas Show from Oxford, England. Right now, we're talking to Professor Walter Hooper about all things C.S. Lewis. Let's rejoin the conversation.
You can never refute these things 100%. There are always people who are sloppy and who will hear these things and so on and so forth. But yeah, for what it's worth, this has been put to rest more than once. I mean, it's very dead, but it's still interesting. The idea that to be so closely affiliated with someone's oeuvre, it really strikes me as the idea for a spectacular novel. You know, sort of like the Aspern Papers. I can't even remember the plot, but the idea of this literary skullduggery.
Stephen King could do it.
Yeah, yeah. Perhaps he could.
Yeah.
But I don't read his trash.
Yeah.
No, that's not true. He's a good writer, but I actually don't read King. But I just think it's such a great idea for a novel, especially since I know that it isn't actually true in this case. But I just love Lewis's just that fragment. Again, it's just such a treasure. There's so many treasures out there. We're probably out of time for today. I think we have another moment or two. You told me earlier that you'd had a conversation with a Skylab astronaut about the Dark Tower.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell that story?
I will. I'm one of the most unusual visitors that I've ever had. Was Joseph Kerwin.
Joseph Kerwin.
He's a medical doctor, but who's also an astronaut. And he said that he was educated in a Jesuit institution, and he was led, while there, he read Lewis's science fiction, especially Out of the Silent Planet and the others. And this led him to become an astronaut.
Wow.
He was the doctor in Skylab when he and other astronauts circled the Earth for a whole...
In the late 70s,
for a month. He had become very fond of the Dark Tower, and he spent his time... He had quite a lot of time in the Skylab, and he tried to complete... The Dark Tower. I haven't seen this completion of it, but he visited me twice here and talked about writing.
But the idea that he was influenced to become an astronaut, because there haven't been too many of those, by Lewis's science fiction trilogy.
But he said that after they came down to Earth from Skylab...
You don't mean that literally.
I mean, when they got back, when the...
When they re-entered the universe?
When they re-entered the universe. Went from the kitchen into the drawing room. But he said he and the other astronauts agreed that Lewis has a better gives a better example of what the Earth looks like from space in out of the sun and planet than they ever could, having been there.
That's just amazing. What a joy to have this time with you, Walter Hooper. For now, we'll say goodbye, and maybe it would be appropriate to have a warm Socrates in the city, Oxford. Thank you to Walter Hooper.
Folks, you've been listening to a special Socrates in the City event from Oxford, England, and it's my privilege to share these events, these conversations with you, my radio audience. I hope you've been enjoying them. We've got more coming up in the next hour. This is a special English version of the Eric Metaxas Show. Stay tuned.